It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go. We are a minute and a half past the hour and ready to begin another edition of The Horn, another Thorn in the Side Thursday for this 16th day of November 2017. Gosh, that means there's 31 and 35, 45 days left in poor old beaten down and bedraggled 2017. And we come into the program this evening in a really, really dark, deep, terrifying hole. Happens from time to time here, but they don't often get this bad. But by God, it has. It certainly has. This has been a tough, tough, tough week for fundraising, especially coming back from a week away. So we all know that I am mathematically challenged and everything, but let's see. Lassie, hey, come here, girl. Come on. There you are. Go tell the sheriff that the horn is down the well again. Atta girl. No. Don't go toward the house. The sheriff. No, we're here. Lassie, come back. Damn that Rin-Tin-Tin. Rats. I don't guess we'll wait for the sheriff. I guess we'll just kind of hope for the best and hope it doesn't rain. So, yeah, math becomes difficult at levels like this, but I think if I've got it right, we are in a fundraising hole that is $644.33 deep. Thanks very kindly to our subscriber, Reinhard in Virginia. Thank you, Reinhard, for kicking in. Much, much appreciated, because it would be much worse without you. And let me just make sure that I'm getting everything right here. Just one second. Just want to get the... I want to get everything in proper order. I know we don't have a whole bunch of subscribers on the 16th day of the month. But in fact, yes, thanks very kindly to Reinhard and to Timothy in Arizona. Thanks to the two of you It's $30 less bad than it would have been otherwise. So much obliged and much appreciated. That's terrifying. $644.33 to go to get even with the week. And there is some good news, however, because we start the program thanks to Ralph's with a $25 challenge. The first $25 in will be doubled by Ralph's. Thank you, Ralph's. Thank you so very, very much. We've got, the bills come due every month. They just do. And I know it may seem silly, but I'm not even going to say it. But anyway, if you want to help out, well, we'd love to have new subscribers. We welcome them. You're welcome to jump in. Just click the little box over at headonradionetwork.com, the one that says make this a recurring monthly donation, and put in a number, and you'll be done. Or you can become a subscriber over at Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/BobKincaid. And there you will see, you'll be joining in with a little handful of other subscribers to help keep things going here. Over at Patreon, your contribution's pulled out on the first of the month, so if you do it like this evening, nothing will happen until the 1st of December, okay? That's how we try to, but if you don't even want to do that, just go to headonradionetwork.com, click on contribute, and kick in that way. Because that's how we keep all of this going. That's interesting. Steve from Georgistan says, I'm not getting a White Rose stream, but Aces is solid. The White Rose thing could be wind crap. Well, no, wind crap is much better now than it was, wasn't it, Steve? It's probably White Rose. I was talking with Ben Birch about that last night, and he did some quick counting, and just by way of giving you an idea, he rebooted the White Rose server last night. Since September, there have been 80,000 separate and distinct attacks on the White Rose server. So that probably gives you an idea of why there's some, but anyway, that's, but at least headon.live is running. Thank you again, Asa. Just a sec. And, yeah, Asa tells me that there's no stream coming through on TuneIn. That means there's no stream coming through White Rose. Strange, but it is what it is. We'll try to count it down from $644.33. In fact, Laurel confirming. Headon.live on my Android is the only way I can hear you now. Any way that we can reach out to Anonymous for some defensive help on this. Oh, there's our first cowbell of the evening. Anyway, we're up and running for what it's worth. And hopefully the Horn family won't come completely unglued, but, you know, it's a little depressing right now, I'm sorry. But it's Thorn in the Side Thursday, and before we jump into the swamp, I wanted to take a moment to share something with you. I had a conversation earlier today with my dear friend Jeff Biggers. We had to do it earlier today because if we were doing it right now, it would be 10 minutes past one his time. Or maybe 10 minutes past midnight his time. And I didn't want to keep him up until 1 o'clock in the morning because Jeff's over in civilization, otherwise known as Europe. And he's got a new book out. And it is absolutely wonderful. So I'm gonna share with you what the discussion that we had just a few hours earlier today. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Don't worry, don't fret, don't be critical or anything. The entire program is not in the can. It's just that there was no way to have this conversation run live. All right, so here we go. I'm joined now by one of our dearest friends of the program, someone with whom I've been carrying on conversations about his work and work related to mountaintop removal, other and other social topics, cultural topics, for about as long as this program's been on the air. Jeff Biggers joins me now. Jeff has just published a magnificent new book. It's called The Trials of a Scold, The Incredible True Story of Writer Ann Royal. And I first found out about Ann Royal via Jeff's work in his award-winning book, The United States of Appalachia, and she has been a captivating character to me ever since. Jeff, thank you for joining us, and thanks for the book.
Thank you, Bob. It's always great to be back on your show. You know, I think you did the first interview 12 years ago with me. So
I think so, yeah.
It's amazing how...
But as I said, I learned about Ann Royal in the United States of Appalachia, and apparently she was enough of a captivating character to you that you hung on to her story as well and have now given her her own book. And it comes out via St. Martin's Press at the right now. It's brand new. It couldn't come out at a better time because although she's working in the first half of the 19th century, her story seems somehow very, very fresh and very real in light of the issues with which we as a nation are still grappling. Is that an accident or is that entirely purpose-driven on your part?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. When I've carried this story really with me for 15 years or so. I stumbled onto her myself when I was traveling in West Virginia and looking at incredible stories and histories and people who I felt had been overlooked by many of the chroniclers. And when I found Ann Royal, I thought, you know, here's this woman. She was quite possibly the most famous woman of her time, this woman who was not only a famed publisher and writer and journalist, been a great muckraker, but really a groundbreaking, trailblazing satirist, someone who was profoundly funny. And someone who had really shattered the ceilings for the role of women in the corridors of power, both in Washington, D.C., but also on a national level. And there was just many other parts of her stories that I just couldn't believe that, you know, somehow she had fallen through the cracks of history. And so I really had to go back and ask why. Why had historians kind of thrown her to the heap pile of kind of crazy old women and hysterical people and eccentric person? And I realized that was ultimately intentional. Here was a woman who had been an incredible agitator, a woman who had very much would resonate today, who spoke back, who resisted, who persisted, you know, even though she had been warned, a woman who refused to back down to men. And I think that story and the cautionary tale of her life, someone who paid a tremendous price for her trailblazing role, really resounds today, especially as we're dealing with many issues of freedom of press, freedom of speech, and the role of women, of course, both in media and the politics.
And that having been said, you know, the title of the book is The Trials of a Scold. That isn't just something you came up with. That actually happened. A scold is a particular pejorative reference, and in fact a legal reference that was applied only to women in that era. Tell us a little bit, and it's also the taking off point for the whole book. Tell us a little bit about the scold trial of Anne Royal.
Right. You know, I try to use that title as in kind of a in two ways. One, of course, is the literal trial that she was had to go through in Washington. We'll talk about that in a second. And the bigger title too is the idea that she was constantly on trial all of her life as a woman, as a writer, as a journalist, as someone from West Virginia. You know, here's a woman who brought the word redneck into our American vocabulary. And the trial itself, of course, is really bizarre, Bob. This is perhaps one of the most bizarre trials we had in Washington, D.C. Certainly wasn't new. As you pointed out, the law, it's a common law, it's actually a law in the books, refers to women only who are essentially public nuisance, people, women who talk too much, or ultimately just bother men. And if a man had a problem with a woman, he was able to take her to court and have her convicted as a common scold. And this really came out of an ancient English-Scottish tradition to silence women who dared to confront men. And so we had, you know, all the way back to the 1600s, you know, around 1650s, 1660s, in some of the earliest American colonies, you had trials against scolds. And this continued all the way up into the 1800s. And, of course, Anne Royal's was probably the most famous trial because here was a woman who had really riveted America. She had published many, many books as a travel writer. She had written many articles. She was his larger-than-life persona. And she had gone after the political and religious elite and called them out. And more importantly, she didn't just sort of expose them for a level of corruption and collusion in terms of politics, but she made fun of them. She mocked men. She wrote these hilarious satirical passages, and that's something that men couldn't live with. And so they literally conjured up these charges, got a grand jury, passed it to a district attorney, and the U.S. government convicted her in Washington in 1829 as a common scold. And typically the punishment for being a scold was to dunk them into a river. And in fact, in the Potomac River along the riverbed near the Navy, they actually had constructed a type of device that they were going to use. But the fact that Anne Royal at that time was considered elderly, she was 60 years old, they decided to just give her a fine and not dunk her into the river. What they didn't realize, of course, is that Anne Royal wasn't finished. She ultimately got her revenge. She went off on this incredible book tour, and she came back, and she launched a newspaper as a woman publisher, editor, and writer using a gaggle of orphans and a small collective of people, and published a newspaper in Washington for the next 25 years.
And that was Paul Pry, was it not?
Paul Pry, which was based on a kind of a funny English play, that's why they used that name, Paul Pry. And then she eventually changed it over and called the newspaper The Huntress. And, of course, that was based, The Huntress, of course, is the name of Mary Bailey, the great West Virginian revolutionary hero that Anne very much admired. Anne Bailey, excuse me, not Mary Bailey, but Anne Bailey.
But her entire history is one of privation and struggle. And she worked within a milieu, that most historians would call the Second Great Awakening, a religious mania that gripped the country of, for all intents and purposes, a desire toward fundamentalist theocracy, similar to what we see today, people who want to impose their religious views and values upon the rest of the nation. And she didn't take well to it, and was even tell me if I'm wrong. She was even attacked by clergy, was she not?
Oh yes. I mean, I think if there's anybody who has stood between the division of church and state, someone who upheld our Constitution, it was someone like Anne Royal. If we kind of step back for a second and give a historical perspective, we can see for her, it just wasn't an issue, but it was really a part of her whole life mission. Anne was born in Baltimore in 1769, and then her family immediately went out to the frontier in western Pennsylvania. Her father died, her mother and Anne barely survived the massacre at Hannahtown in western Pennsylvania at the end of the American Revolution, when there was all sorts of battles being fought, even if the revolution was over. They were so poor, the mother and her children, that they went into Virginia, in Staunton, Virginia, and then into West Virginia, working as servants. And this is a period where, in fact, such poverty was not unique, but to have a white servant within these slave states was, in fact, not as common as we can imagine. They were actually sent to Sweet Springs for a reason, because Anne's mother really suffered from a nervous disorder. And she went there, actually, like many people, into Monroe County, West Virginia, for health reasons, you know, to somehow find a job, find some way to survive, and some actually help herself. She was really ailing. And she and Anne became servants to a man who was a very wealthy plantation owner who had come over from the Tidewater eastern coast of Virginia, and after the American Revolution, basically wanted to disappear into the woods. And this man, his name was Royal. His name was William Royal. He had been a colonel in the American Revolution, a friend of Thomas Jefferson, incredibly wealthy, an old, old family. And he had created this incredible plantation and filled it with books. He probably had the greatest library in the region, here in the woods of Monroe County, West Virginia. And here comes this teenager. Anne, at that point, was about 18 years old, and her mother, and they work as servants. And, of course, Royal, who at that point was in his late 30s, he was obviously an iconoclastic. He was a free thinker, someone who still followed the 18th century enlightenment of the French. He loved Thomas Paine, of course, who had been vilified with his free thinking and deist beliefs, and who wrote The Age of Reason. And Anne sort of just, you know, walked into this incredible private university, so to speak. And she and Royal eventually began a relationship. They openly cohabitated together without getting married, and eventually they got married and lived together for many, many years. When Royal and William Royal died, his family, of course, wanted his fortune, and they didn't realize, in fact, his fortune had been diminishing very quickly, and they took Anne to court, essentially accusing her of being a concubine, nothing more than just a woman he had brought on. And after many years of litigation, Anne lost everything. And so here's a woman now who's in her 50s, completely full of debts, on the run, literally on the lam, and who had nothing to speak of. And therefore she goes to Alabama and she begins writing letters. And of course her friends are encouraging her, hey, you should really turn these letters into some sort of book. And that begins her incredible career at the age of 57 as a writer. Talk about someone who reinvents herself with this powerful story. But her stories were not just, you know, about what she saw. It was this long-standing belief as a free thinker in the separation of church and state, in the role of education, in the embetterment and understanding of who we were, and really looking at the national identity of who we are as an American. And that really set her off on this incredible journey, really for the next several decades.
It is an absolutely fascinating story. There's no one portion of it, I think, that stands out over another. You mentioned, of all the places to go, she went to Alabama. Of course, I was born and raised there in not too far at all from where she went. And that then, at that point in time, that was the frontier. That was the Missouri and later on the California of far later in the century. That was the wild fringe of the young nation. And what she saw there was is it safe to say that she was shocked and that she was a little bit disturbed by it?
She was on two levels. One is obviously there was the Alabama fever, that everybody was heading west when it was opened up, both for land and for cultivation and any kind of quick profit people could make, especially as they then shifted over to Georgia. And so she at first was kind of swept up in this Alabama fever. But then she began to really realize what was behind it, that you had this incredible wealthy aristocracy that controlled most of the land, that had sent land agents ahead, and then you had just small groups of very poor people who were working the land, of course, in the tremendous role of slavery as well. And Anna began to analyze this, someone who is both wrapped up in it, but at the same time realizing it was going wrong. At the same time, Bob, this is where it becomes really interesting today, is she couldn't believe, you know, as you've mentioned before, the role of religion in ultimately hoodwinking people to maintain really what was happening there. You know, she said, hey, here are these revivals come through with the Great Awakening and the evangelical churches. And basically, she felt like the whole role of the church was to keep people ignorant, to keep them from going to school, to keep them beholden to the aristocracy, to basically keep women down and keep them dispossessed, and to maintain slavery. And so here's one of the early analysis of the evangelical movement beyond any kind of religious analysis of looking at the cultural dynamic and how it ultimately was suppressing people and pulling them back, holding them back and allowing this kind of system to go on. And I think today when we think of people like, you know, Moore down there running for the Senate in Alabama, I immediately think of people like Anne Royal when she went back to Alabama about 10 years later in the 1820s. She couldn't believe what had happened. She writes, she writes these incredible letters saying, you know, what happened to the people? Why have they completely, you know, become beholden to these evangelical movements? You know, and think about it, that's 2 centuries ago, and this 2 centuries of an entrenched stranglehold on a cultural development down there.
And it really does. It obtains to this day, Jeff. I can bear witness to that. But so I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. How did she come to coin the term redneck?
You know, it's very funny. If you called Anne Royal the first redneck feminist, she would be outraged, because redneck was a derogatory term that she used on evangelicals, largely the Presbyterians. You know, we often think of Presbyterians today, of course, as these kind of, you know, middle class Scottish folks from the upper Northeast and whatnot. You know, the
why Donald Trump claims to be a Presbyterian.
Oh, in the main Philadelphia was one of the main places for the Presbyterian Church and whatnot. But in fact, the Presbyterians had an incredible role in the 1820s and 1830s. There was a man in Philadelphia, a preacher, who basically pushed the concept of creating a Christian party. Now, this guy was the moral majority before Jerry Falwell. He was the moral majority before, you know, Ralph Reed and everything that happened with the Family Council and whatnot in the South in the last years. You know, long before Billy Graham and his son, 2 centuries ago, you had this incredible push to create a Christian party where only Christians could be elected as political figures. And it seems outlandish today, doesn't it? But at the same time, it really, really became close to becoming a reality. And there were very few people willing to confront this wave of support for a mixing of religion and politics. And here comes Anne Royal, once again, this single woman, you know, with bedraggled clothing, you know, who could barely pay for anything, who had this wicked sense of humor, this wonderful way, this incredible biblical knowledge, a woman who could go toe-to-toe with any preacher and match him both in Greek or Latin or any kind of biblical scripture. And she really tried to point out the danger of bringing politics and religion together, especially in the form of this Christian party.
So not only is she a cultural observer, she also gets herself wrapped up in technology, doesn't she? I'm thinking primarily of the first form of electronic communication, you know, the telegraph.
Exactly. In fact, I even refer to Anne Royal as the first blogger. And I say that not because she was posting blogs on the internet, because she was the first person who wrote and published her own work in a sense of, having free editorial reign over what she was going to do. She had this incredible sense. You know, here's someone you know, once again, Bob, this is the kind of thing you and I have talked about a lot, but, you know, some of our greatest innovations, both in terms of technology and science and arts and literature and humanities, often come from the rural areas, places that really are at the forefront or the forefront of conflict and friction, where people have, you know, worked to kind of have sort of breakthroughs, both in science and technology. And Anne was fascinated by all this stuff. She was hardly beholden to her era, hardly beholden to the 18th century or even the early 19th century. She constantly was writing about new innovations and new innovators. She constantly wanted to meet every scientist. She wanted to meet every engineer. She wanted to interview everybody. She wrote what she called pen portraits, where she'd go around and interview people and then literally write kind of a profile on people as if she was doing a painting. In fact, many people even credit her with being the first journalist to use quotation marks. But I really wasn't able to confirm that. But definitely many people single her out. But she, you know, Samuel Morse, of course, for years had been trying to come up with his telegraph scheme. One thing about Samuel Morse I think we forget about is, you know, he went to Europe to become a painter, and he failed. And even if some of his paintings are shown in some of the major museums today, he wasn't just an inventor. He also was a great artist. And he and his father deeply admired Anne. And to me, it was a great example of people who politically didn't get along. His father was a theologian, but at the same time, and he was a geographer too. They very much appreciated Anne's chutzpah and her ability to engage with them and talk, and they often would host her. And Morse, of course, when he finally tested his famous telegraph for the first time there in the Capitol Hill, Anne was right there with him. And of course, there's that famous, you know, what hath God wrought, I believe was the first message he sent to Baltimore.
Yes.
And they responded. And then he asked around the room, is there anything else we should mention? Excuse me. And someone said, well, tell him Mrs. Royal sends her best wishes. And so that was one of the earliest things ever sent on the telegram. And of course they responded, you know, best wishes back to Mrs. Royal.
And that was specifically because of the efforts that she had made to get federal funding for the new gizmo, right?
Exactly. She had often been an advocate. She had written, you know, long in her newspaper about how we needed to support innovators and technology and people like Morse, you know, and she'd been a longtime supporter. And once again, the role of her newspaper, her newspaper, you know, was a kind of like a, you know, in our generation, of course, there was I.F. Stone, the great journalist who had really been known for his work on the Vietnam War. And here was basically her own little newspaper that she had her causes that she went after. She was really the watchdog on Capitol Hill for 25 years. She was called the Holy Terror by the Washington Post. But it was a woman who really was trying to understand how things worked and how we could do them better. You know, someone who really, in every sense, was a muckraker. She was trying to get away from the politics and the corruption and the gossip and all that thing. And she really wanted to get to the crux of what really mattered. And in that sense, I profoundly appreciated her. You know, in many respects, you know, Anne Royal was, you know, she definitely perfected the art of the rant. She would go on these incredible rants. She would attack people. She could be incredibly destructive. At the same time, she had this resiliency about her that I thought was incredibly important, especially for today's period of looking at how important the freedom of press and freedom of speech is and how important women have been. And really making sure that we keep pushing forward for some sort of social progress.
And along the way, as often happens in these sorts of in these sorts of lives, she also leaves us with stunning pictures of the world in her time, things that we would not otherwise know, portraits of what her upbringing was like, what it was like to live on the western frontier in Pennsylvania, and these conversations, these pen portraits that we wouldn't otherwise have. You know, we don't think about. There's just so many things that unless you're consciously pursuing them, you don't know or think about. Dolly Madison, was broke, living in more or less poverty. James Madison had long since died, and she interviewed Dolly Madison, did she not?
Yeah, she came, and, you know, once again, Anne Royal didn't ever hesitate from just literally walking to someone's house and knocking on the door in order to have an interview. And I think at the same time, she wanted to look at certain historical figures, and especially women. You know, I think to me what was very important is Anne said, hey, the histories are all written about queens and the rich, and why don't we begin to also tell the story of other women? That in fact, women have the same rights as men, and common women particularly. And so, of course, Dolly Madison, coming from a particularly elite background, that someone, as you mentioned, you know, the Madison fortune because of their son and debts and whatnot, had really declined. She really wanted to get out and tell stories of people who had been forgotten. And I think that became really a cautionary tale about her own life, is that, you know, almost immediately after her own death, we forgot about who Anne Royal was, and we went on to other issues.
And we did, but we didn't just forget her. She was thrown down the memory hole, don't you think?
Oh, totally. And I think, once again, it's by these same historians and same journalists who were older men who just simply couldn't handle the fact that there was this defiant woman who was probably a better writer than they were, who was a great satirist, who made people laugh and make them laugh at them. You know, remember, Bob, we're talking about a period in which we could laugh at women, but we weren't allowed, we didn't allow women to laugh at us. We weren't allowed to have women have a sense of humor. And I think that role of humor is something that we really need to be looking more into. You know, so much of her work, people interpreted literally and would say, see how she, you know, these exaggerated claims and these exaggerated writings, and she's obviously a mad woman, not realizing it's no different than Mark Twain. You know,
well, I was getting ready to go there, Jeff. She's writing travelogues, arguably because he was such an autodidact. I would not be surprised to find out that Sam Clemens read Anne Royal, and she predated him both from the travelogue and the humor perspective. Did she not? Not let alone satire.
Oh, by a generation, and she literally. Broke the trails on these stagecoaches and wagons and walking, you know, from Alabama all the way up to Maine, all the way out to the Mississippi River. You know, here's a woman who met Lim Clark, you know, in St. Louis, a woman who literally, you know, went from town to town writing about it, and often in a very funny way. And yeah, of course, I feel like, you know, Twain had to have known who Anne Royal was, like so many people. She really, in her day, you could name, you know, only on one hand, five other women who were as important or as famous as Anne Royal was. You know, she had that kind of prestige and status in society, mainly because she had literally been so involved in so many different ways.
You know, there's a through line that runs from her work and her disdain for religious divines and religious intolerance, and really gets picked up and carried forward by Twain. Twain refers to, there's a short story of Twain's called The Funeral of Buck Fanshaw, or Buck Fanshaw's Funeral, from the Nevada mining camps, in which he refers to a local parson as a gospel sharp.
Exactly.
And of course, a sharp was a term for, you know, a confidence man, a con man. And you know, you wonder if he would have been as free to do that had she not laid this groundwork.
Right. You know, and I think also it just reminds us that there were these people willing to write in a way that was extremely risky at that moment, you know, and who are definitely, as you say, are following this continuum of writers. And I would say that even goes back to people like Tom Paine, you know, another incredible American writer who was completely thrown under the bus, as we say, and completely forgotten, not because he was one of the great founders of our nation, the man who literally gave us the name, the United States of America, but because he dared to take on the religious elite and write his book, Age of Reason, which really questions a lot of the Bible and the role of Christianity. You know, and so I think Anne knew exactly what she was walking into. And I think this is the other great story, really, for us, Bob, is that know, Anne Royal, you know, didn't have just a second chance, a second life, as F. Scott Fitzgerald said every American has. She had 3 and 4 and 5 and 9 lives. She walked through the fire so much. She was horsewhipped in Pennsylvania. She was thrown down the stairs in Vermont by a religious extremist and shattered her leg. You know, she'd been convicted in Washington and humiliated. And yet this woman persisted. She really went on to become an incredible muckraker, an incredible satirist, incredible social critic, a woman who emerged out of West Virginia and wrote her first book at the age of 57, you know, in a period when, you know, that was probably the extent of life for most people, who went on to live to the age of 85, printing her newspaper, you know, just a few months before she died at 85, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton comes to visit her, you know, because she's this woman you have to meet in Washington. And I think that's the kind of story I really wanted to bring out, was we have all these people in their lives who have reinvented themselves just like we've reinvented our country, who've really, you know, provided these stories and backstories and histories that really, really have made up who we are. And we're following their continuum today. You know, you can't talk about women in the media. You can't turn on the TV and watch Samantha Bee without thinking about Anne Royal and her own sense of humor. And I think that's what we need with history, is to tell how that story still is an incredible presence in our daily lives.
Well, as we've talked, that's one of the things that's been running through my mind, Jeff, is this. I hope that people like Samantha Bee or Tina Fey will get some, somebody will put them onto this book of yours, because frankly, Anne Royal deserves, and you have made a tremendous effort in this regard. Anne Royal deserves her place in the pantheon of American greats. The genius of what you've done here is to take what is typically, you know, we look, so many people look at history as dry and boring. It's not just enough to bring the stories alive, but to make a person alive in our hearts. And from the first time I found out about her, and now having read the book, I don't just admire Anne Royal. I'm fond. This is gonna. I don't mean any. I'm fond of her. I mean, she makes my heart happy thinking about what she was doing back then. It is. It's more than an appreciation of a life, but a celebration of it. And people like Tina Fey. I mentioned Tina Fey, Sam Bee. There are others. Need to have her on their radar. Because it's often said that we stand on the shoulders of giants. Sometimes people don't know the names of the giants upon whose shoulders they stand. Who among us, male or female, would have the courage to sit in that trial and not just meekly listen to the charges read, but to give them hell in return? Right. This is, I mean, there's a Mark Twain Prize for humor. Why isn't that, you know, maybe going forward, maybe there's some philanthropist, wealthy comedian out there who would like to fund an Anne Royal Prize, because there damned sure should be one. And in this book, you've proven that. And for that, I thank you. And maybe, Jeff, one of the reasons that I feel so fondly toward her is because she comes from what would later become West Virginia. We get kind of clannish about our fellow hillbillies, past, present, and future. But thanks to you putting me onto her work, I found out that in 1824, she interviewed one of my distant relations.
Oh, really? Who's that?
1824, she profiled Frances Welch.
Okay, there you go.
At the time, she was 70. She was 70 years old, and she described her. And this is a quote, and I used quotation marks when I wrote it down. Thanks, Anne. The most extraordinary woman I ever saw, and went on to describe her as eminently qualified to adorn the most polished assembly. And that's probably, I'm not for sure, I haven't been able to get back far enough, but that's probably great, 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 great granny. And she was also the mother or grandmother of, you know, we've all got our crosses to bear, the mother or grandmother of a Confederate officer who was so disgusted by the defeat of the South that he left the country forever and went over and sold his services to the exalted noble, whatever he was, of Egypt, and died in Egypt.
That's an incredible story, right?
But that was all taking place down not far from where she had grown up, because that was down in what is now Greenbrier County, West Virginia, in and around the area of what was known as Fort Donelly and Sinking Springs and that area. But she gave us a picture of an America that the other historians didn't largely haven't given us. And she was, lest anyone think otherwise, she was not entirely despised, was she? She had her fans.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she was either revered or reviled. In fact, she laughed that when she'd walk into the room, half the room would run away and half the room would crowd around her for an autograph. And I think she picked her sides. And I think, you know, people responded, as you can imagine. So, yeah, she definitely was not someone who, you know, she definitely was despised by the elite and despised by, you know, ultimately I would say the corrupt aristocracy. And I think that's a good people to be despised by.
I couldn't agree more. And again, thank you, Jeff Biggers. And the book is The Trials of a Scold. It is out right now from St. Martin's Press. And available wherever you buy books, online and in traditional but often disappearing brick and mortar bookstores. Again, Jeff Biggers, thank you so very much.
Great, Bob. Always great to be on your show.
It's always a pleasure. And that is my conversation with Jeff Biggers. Again, the book, The Trials of a Scold, The Incredible True Story of writer Ann Royal. And like I said, it's out right now. And I've already read it. I can't recommend it highly enough. Truth be told, I read it months and months and months ago because Jeff was kind enough to involve me in the editorial process. And as I said, or maybe I didn't, it needs to be a TV show or a movie. I love books, but let's face facts. So here's something. This is really cool. Courtesy of our buddy Jug of Punch, who just wrote in. Get this. He was impressed. All Nary One and Royal Challenge. I will match the next $10 with a gift purchase of the book. Just have them send you shipping details, and the horn gets $20, and the match receives the book. So the next $10 contributor gets a copy of Trials of a Scold. You have to send me your mailing address, though. And I will communicate that to Thomas, and Thomas will make sure the book gets to you. You're going to, let's see, it's hardback. It's thoroughly sourced. Complete bibliography. End notes. And takes up 230 pages. And it's some of the most fascinating history you never knew. This woman was at the epicenter of many of the great doings of the first half of the 19th century. So that's on the table. And I really think you'd get a kick out of it. I also have big thanks to send out to John. As the program, as the interview was running, I got a note in. Have a happy Thanksgiving celebration. I'm grateful for the whole Horn community. That last conversation you had with Todd was classic. Peace, John. And so, also, I can announce that Ralph's challenge was met. And so on this Down the Well Thursday evening, I can happily announce that we have gone from $644.33 to $584.33, thanks to Ralph's challenge. And thanks to John, down to $384.33. $384.33 is what we've got to catch up with for the remainder of the week. Note coming in from Ron in the I ain't sure if it's frozen yet or not, North. I finally have the opportunity to listen. Enjoyed Jeff Biggers. Guests like that add a welcome dimension to our continuing path to enlightenment. And he talks real good, too. Jeff do talk real good. And so, thanks, Ron. And I guess, Amazon delivery. I'm gonna. Like I said, I've got a hardback copy. I'll wind up having it on my Kindle as well. I've never gotten around to doing the Barnes & Noble ebook thing. I just stick with what I know works. But this is a page turner. This is America before the Civil War. And it is, as a result, where American history is concerned, there's the Declaration of Independence and the Revolution up to the ratification of the Constitution. And, you know, okay, the Louisiana Purchase and Lewis and Clark. And pretty much as soon as Lewis and Clark gets back, okay, there's the War of 1812, and we know a little bit about that. I mean, for instance, it was the War of 1812 that gave us the notorious racist Francis Scott Key writing a poem about all the awful things he wanted to have happen to black people, slaves, who had risen up against their masters and joined the answered a call to join the royal military. And it becomes our national anthem. But from the War of 1812 to the Civil War is sort of this vast empty space that is actually chock-a-block with some of the most compelling history you would ever want to know, and most of us don't know squat about it. Yay, Darlene will be the proud recipient of the book. Thank you, Darlene. Darlene, just as a matter of fact, Darlene just took us down even further to 300. No, did I say no? To $284.33. $284.33. Thank you, Darlene. You went above and beyond, but you will get the book, and I will see to it that Thomas gets your address post haste. You're going to love this. The thing is, she also serves as a primary source for what the Western frontier, the movement toward the Allegheny front, was. And as Jeff pointed out, and this is somewhat food for thought, she was a teenage girl who entered into a relationship with a relatively older man. But what a far cry from what a far cry from the sort of thing that we're hearing about now. It's not like Captain Royal was sitting around down to the old Hickory House, or cruising the Red Lobster, or trying to pick up Santa's little helper. There's a big, big, big damn difference. And in point of fact, as Jeff talks about the library that Captain Royal had, well, she got as good an education as there was to be had out of the relationship. He was also Captain Royal was also a Freemason, as were many of those Enlightenment folks of the Revolutionary era. And she became a defender because part of the Great Awakening's hysteria, and again, it resonates through our history to the current day, the present day. Part of the Awakening, which was actually the Great Dumbing Down, was a hysteria against the Masons. Because, among other things, the Masons had a more nuanced view of religion. And they tended to be people who were not inclined toward the pious, hypocritical ignorance that was promulgated by the religion industry of the day. And just as there are many other reflections, if you will, through history's mirror to the current era, you can find that when you see the occasional, it's almost unavoidable, when you see some idiot blathering on about the Illuminati or dithering away about, the Rothschilds, okay? You're seeing the same sort of close-minded, ignorant mindset that that first really, really took root in this country in the so-called awakenings. So there's that. Keith jumped in too, in an effort to, in regards to the book. I will see to it. I'll see to it that you get a copy, Keith. So there we go. And Ron points out, and it seems that he has had an impact on the bottom line. True, true indeed. So that's pretty much the first hour of this Thorn in the Side Thursday, and God knows we've got oodles to talk about. And hopefully we will we'll knock down that remaining $284.33. Yeah, I've still got Thomas to thank for the $4.33 part from last night. Thanks, because ciphering is so much fun. But $284.33 is where we stand, and then if we can do that, then all we got to do is raise the usual $200 tomorrow. And don't worry, next week again, program note: no program Wednesday, no program Friday. That's not going to be included in fundraising. So we've got this week, and then 3 days of next week to worry about. And yippee, the holidays are upon us. I shouldn't sound so jaded in that regard. Let's see, what else? Well, it is Thursday, and that means, unless I'm completely off the mark, that means that we will have the Green News Report, courtesy of Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. Let's see. And, of course, your conversation, our conversation, that which makes the horn such a, such a unique experience in the whole broadcast broadcast universe. Yeah, what do you mean, Scott? Scott and Punky said, that 33 cents figure is rather suspect. 33rd degree Masonic? Just saying. Oh, God, please, no, not, too soon. I can't do it tonight. I just can't. And they only go up to 32 degrees. Or is it 33? I don't know enough about that. It's, well, whatever. 33rd degree, 32nd degree? You know, after you get past Master Mason, everything else is just another degree that you pay for. But you got to have all your degrees before you can be a Shriner, I guess. I always wanted to be a Shriner just so I could drive around one of those fun little cars that, you know, spat fire and everything. Now, Ron says, the Masonic view towards religion continues to this day. The principal requirement is to be of good character, respected by your fellows in the community, and belief in a supreme being. The obligations can be sworn on a Bible, a Torah, a Quran, etc. The other principal rule is that within a lodge, the brethren will brook no discussions or arguments about either religion or politics. There we go. Because that's, yeah, makes sense. So anyway, want to get involved in the program? Well, you know the number, 304-574-8178, or Skype to Skype from anywhere on planet Earth, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn at, well, just Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. And, I had it backwards. 33rd degree is an honorary appointment, Ron says. You can be a Shriner after you become a Master Mason. Okay, so you don't have to get them. You don't have to get all the way up to 32nd degree Noble Turk. Yeah, after the after my adolescent experience with Thimalay, I always wanted to do the lodge thing, but I don't know why I never got around to it. So let's take a break. What have we got tunage-wise? Oh, what would be appropriate after that conversation? And how about that? The inventor, there are a lot of people who think that the idea of redneck was born in the mine wars. And that, no, it wasn't. No, a woman did it. And she did it a hell of a long time before the West Virginia mine wars came along. As Scott points out, the nuns used to tell me, Master Mason, ha, subject line, Master Mason, the nuns used to tell me it'd make you go blind. Yeah, I think that was something else, maybe, I understand. Oh, that was just bad. Just the tiniest of jingles for that, Scott. Thrown down a flight of stairs, horsewhipped by good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christians. Oh, well, it doesn't exactly fit, but hey, there's never a bad time for this. So we'll take a break, see what's going on, and come back after the Green News Report. I'm Bob Kincaid. Every day.
It's Thursday, November 16, 2017.
I know people would like to say that these caribou or polar bear want to cozy up to a pipeline, but that is just not true.
Alaska's pristine National Wildlife Refuge, now one step closer to oil drilling.
Pollution has a disproportionate effect on our communities.
African Americans bear the brunt of U.S. fossil fuel pollution. Global carbon dioxide emissions are increasing for the first time in years. Plus, France will cover U.S. funding responsibilities for U.N. climate science.
All of those embarrassments and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Syria has announced plans to sign the Paris Climate Accord, joining 196 other countries, making the United States the sole UN member country to stand against this deal. It's called American exceptionalism, as in, we're the one exception.
This is your Green News Report.
We're like an island, but not actually, thank God. Islands are having a really hard time right now for some reason.
Okay, Desi Doyen, Republicans have for years, decades, I think, been trying to do this, trying to drill in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. It looks like this time it may actually happen.
Yes, it actually does look like that. On Wednesday, the majority Republicans in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee pushed through a provision to open up some of the pristine Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas exploration, despite opposition from the vast majority of Americans, by attaching it to their tax cut bill, claiming that the small amount of revenue from drilling will offset their $1.5 trillion tax cut. In a testy hearing, Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington State noted that the oil industry already has millions of untouched acres right next door in the Alaska National Petroleum Reserve. And she excoriated Alaska Republicans and the Trump Administration Interior Department for claiming that wilderness and oil development can coexist.
I'm just amazed that people want to throw away such an unbelievable ecological jewel of our planet. I don't even just mean our nation, I mean our planet. We think that it's a critical habitat that should be protected and that it is not consistent with oil and gas development.
And that position was echoed by the Audubon Society, which called the refuge crucial for endangered species, saying, quote, there is no such thing as a wilderness oil field. You've either got wilderness or you've got an oil field. Mm. They and other conservation groups are calling on Americans to call their congressional representatives to stop the land grab of America's last intact wilderness. Global carbon dioxide emissions are increasing again for the first time in 3 years. That's according to preliminary data for 2017 released by the Global Carbon Project this week. The report found that total annual carbon emissions from fossil fuels and industrial sources rose 2% higher than last year after remaining flat for 3 years in a row.
I was going to say, I thought they have been down or at least flat for many years. Now they're back up. Any idea why?
Yeah, they say largely it is driven by increased burning of coal in China and India, but they also say that the United States and Europe have slowed down their rate of cutting their emissions. Mm. And part of that slowdown in cutting emissions for the United States is a slight increase in coal burning because of the Trump administration's rollback of air pollution public health regulations, and also an increase in methane leaks from natural gas drilling on public lands. Methane is a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2, and now a new study has measured those leaks from drilling in New Mexico and found that the climate impact of methane leaks from natural gas drilling are, quote, equivalent to 12 coal-fired power plants.
And they also lose money for the companies. You would think that they would want to capture this methane in some way.
And sell it, but they're also wasting royalties that are supposed to go
to the American taxpayer, exactly.
African-American communities bear the brunt of air pollution from oil and gas facilities. That's according to a new study commissioned by the NAACP, which found that African-Americans are 75% more likely to live near toxic oil and gas facilities that churn out more than 9 million tons of toxic air pollutants every year. And that has serious health impacts, including higher rates of asthma among African-American children. But finally, there is a bit of good news, sort of, that emerged from the UN climate talks now underway in Bonn, Germany. Other nations are trying to pick up the slack and the responsibilities of the United States in the wake of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the landmark Paris Climate Agreement. On Wednesday, French President Emmanuel Macron announced at the conference that France and Europe will cover the United States' funding responsibilities for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's preeminent organization for global climate research.
Thank you, France. And on behalf of the U.S., I'm sorry. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I'm sorry. So sorry that I'm...
All righty then. Nothing like a... Yeah, what a song. You hear that and you just start to sway a little bit and you can almost see the mirror ball turning slowly about. Let's see here. Let me do that. Yeah. Rats. And I got to figure out why that's coming, why the Skype noise is coming through on the production machine. Oh, I need a staff. I did miss one thing. When Keith kicked in a little bit ago, he threw in the 1033. Keith says to, I sent the 1033 to even it out. Odd number amounts seem to bother me for some reason. Wish I could help more. You help a lot, Keith. Oh, you help a lot. Thank you so much. So now it's just, Yeah, I failed. Didn't take into account the 33. So it's just 284. So thank you. No, it's not 284. It's 274. 274 even. Wonderful. Thank you. All right. Let's go over. Because we haven't heard from him in a little while. Let's go over and check in and see what Angry's up to. Hey, Angry.
Hey, my man, can you actually hear me? Because you sound really muddy. Listen.
I hear you, and but I'm getting a return of me from you.
Me from you. All right, so wanted you to strike all of me back.
Okay. I called you the last time. You call me. Yeah, that was a mess. Let's try this again. Any better?
Slight mess.
Okay, you're breaking up something fierce. And I've still got return coming to me.
This is why you need to move open source, Bob.
Not, dude, it's your open source. No offense, but I mean, this is open source is a nightmare. I gotta run on stuff that's reliable.
Open source is reliable with other open source.
Yeah, but then
you know, Microsoft got there.
But then I'd lose. Then I'd lose everybody else. That's the problem.
Hey, that's the problem. Blame the corporations, not us. You know, we're out there trying to make technology available to the people.
Well, someday maybe they will.
Well, I don't know how the hell we're going to do this, so I'm going to back out so someone who has a better feed can get in. But let me do say this for those that can't hear me. This is why you need to, if you can, dig deep, support media like Bob Kincaid, support Mike Malloy, support the Green News Report, support the alternative media that you want to hear, because that way you'll be able to get a clear goddamn feed with up-to-date equipment. Peace.
Well, thanks, Angry. I don't know what the problem is, but it's I know it's damnably frustrating. I did the interview with Jeff Biggers on Skype from Italy, no problem. And I don't know. Let's see. Where then do we go? Well, the lines are still open if you want to get involved in the program. There is some, look, there's real honest to God, no kidding news out there. There's even stuff that doesn't have anything to do with Roy Moore or sexual harassment or anything like that. Although we'll wind up talking about that, I'm sure. By the way, if anybody wants to check the White Rose stream, it may be up and running now. Ben tells me he restarted the server. Like I said, we'll wind up... We'll wind up talking about this sexual, this harassment stuff. Here, let's just go ahead and do it. Because the great big oh my God news of the day is that a woman who has a woman came forward alleging that she had been sexually harassed by Al Franken earlier today. She wasn't harassed by Al Franken earlier today. She came forward earlier today claiming to have been sexually harassed in 2006 by Al Franken. English. It's a language with rules. The backstory on it is that it happened on a USO tour, again, in 2006. He said that he grossly and forcefully kissed her. He said there was a rehearsal for a skit, which they performed. But then the secondary part of it is that he took a photograph, or a photograph was taken of him while she was asleep, with him reaching, you know, mugging for the camera and reaching his hands out as though, and perhaps even, touching her breasts. This is bad. This is the same sort of sophomoric stuff that made him famous on Saturday Night Live. For instance, in the first or second season, when he came on with his comedy partner, Tom Davis, and one of them revealing that they were gay, and then pointing, and maybe it was Al that said, "My God, my children are in," or maybe I don't even remember, but the camera swung around into the audience where there was a woman and a couple of kids sitting in seats, and, "My children are here, my wife is here. How could you say that?" And the skit ends with either Al Franken or Tom Davis committing suicide. Yuck. Horrible. It wasn't even the laughter at the time was of the uneasy sort of kind of, you know, this ain't funny sort of response. And when you're having a picture, you know what the picture of Al Franken reminded me of? It reminded me of the shit that went on in my fraternity and a lot of other fraternities, where a dude would, a brother would pass out drunk, and somebody would come and write things on his face, and then some other guy would put their dick up, and just take a picture next to his mouth, and yeah, that kind of thing. But I believe the woman. I believe her. There's photographic evidence, for Christ's sakes. And if she says that she did not want, the rehearsal kiss didn't want her to go the way she wanted it to go, that's, you gotta believe her. I mean, she said she immediately ran and went to the bathroom to wash the taste of him out of her mouth. So, I believe her. And Al Franken, and here's where the difference comes in. Al Franken said, "Well, I don't remember the rehearsal the way she remembers the rehearsal, but I'm sorry. I apologize." He didn't beat around the bush. He didn't pretend that she was misremembering. He did it. He did it right. There have been no robocalls from, Earther sent me an email just a little bit ago. Subject line, "I'm Bernie Bernstein." Bob, I think the robocall was worse than we thought. Just look at the transcript. "Hi, I'm Jeremiah Blood Matzovich." Wait, I have to put down my bagel. "As a New Yorker who believes the Holocaust actually happened, I work for the New York Times. Naturally, I'm a gender non-binary person who worships Satan, and I'm offering money for information on Roy Moore. I will pay $7,000 for the information. Don't worry for me, as I found this money this morning under my Italian couch cushions." Thank you, Earther. Thank you. There's none of that. Senator Franken did it as close to right as I think you can probably do it. This is the statement that was that he issued. The first thing I want to do is apologize to Leanne, to everyone else who was part of that tour, to everyone who has worked for me, to everyone I represent, and to everyone who counts on me to be an ally and supporter and champion of women. There's more I want to say, but first and foremost, the first and foremost thing, and if it's the only thing you care to hear, and that's fine, is I'm sorry. I respect women. I don't respect men who don't. And the fact that my own actions have given people a good reason to doubt that makes me feel ashamed. But I want to say something else, too. Over the last few months, all of us, including and especially men who respect women, have been forced to take a good hard look at our own actions and think, perhaps shamefully for the first time, about how those actions have affected women. For instance, that picture. I don't know what was in my head when I took that picture, and it doesn't matter. There's no excuse. I look at it now, and I feel disgusted with myself. It isn't funny. It's completely inappropriate. It's obvious how Leanne would feel violated by that picture, and what's more, I can see how millions of other women would feel violated by it, women who have had similar experiences in their own lives, women who fear having those experiences, women who look up to me, women who have counted on me. Coming from the world of comedy, I've told and written a lot of jokes that I once thought were funny, but later came to realize were just plain offensive. Like that gay guy committing suicide skit that I mentioned a few minutes ago, from like 1975 or 1976, when that really was a significant cause of suicide. I mean, that's just a few years after Stonewall, for God's sakes. But the intentions behind my actions aren't the point at all. It's the impact these jokes had on others that matters, and I'm sorry it's taken me so long to come to terms with that. While I don't remember the rehearsal for the skit as Leanne does, I understand why we need to listen and to believe women's experiences. I'm asking that an ethics investigation be undertaken, and I will gladly cooperate. Wow! Haven't heard Roy Moore say that, have you? No. And the truth is, what people think of me in light of this is far less important than what people think of women who continue to come forward to tell their stories. They deserve to be heard and believed, and they deserve to know that I am their ally and supporter. I've let them down, and I am committed to making it up to them. I don't see how you do much better than that. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that apparently, for something that was as traumatic as Leanne Tweeden says it was, she apparently was so traumatized that she shared it with that great paragon of human empathy and sympathy, that political Mother Teresa, Roger Stone, the original rat fucker. Because there is a tweet saying that Roger Stone said, Al Franken's time in the barrel is coming. And then this hit. We're learning a lot about, maybe this is a turning point. You'd like to hope it is. As Jeff Biggers noted in the early to mid-19th century, do you realize what being dunked in the Potomac would have done to Anne Royle? It probably would have killed her. She likely would have taken pneumonia, or perhaps just drowned. The practice had been outlawed in Great Britain by that time. But there were great men of tremendous piety and faith who were insistent upon the idea that she should be so tortured. Again, as Jeff noted, she was horse-whipped. They tried to kill her, and she would not be silent. But they did. Her memory was thrown down, was thrown down a well as soon as she was dead. When she was, when she alive, was able to shake the very foundations of government and culture itself. By the way, Leanne Tweeden, in case you're wondering, she is billed as a former model and news reader for a station in Los Angeles. Well, that's true as far as it goes. She's also a more than once in a while guest on, anybody, drum roll please, Fox News. So what you have here is a desperate attempt that, well, it's a desperate attempt on the part of Republicans to come up with a tat, well, no, let's not use a quid for the Roy Moore quo. And you can well imagine that since Steve Bannon ally Roger Stone knew about it in advance, that this is something they've been trying to find for a while now. Again, I want to be 100% absolutely clear on this matter. I believe her. I believe that she didn't like the rehearsal thing, whatever it was. I believe that. And I believe it made her feel icky. And I believe that. And the stupid sophomoric photo. Al Franken says in his statement, "I don't know what made me take that photo." Unless Al Franken has some sort of prehensile tail with which he can hold a photograph, or with which he can hold a camera at the same time that he is showing both of his hands moving toward or actually on the chest of a sleeping female, he didn't take that photo. Someone else took that photo. And the someone else will, depending on the story that the someone else is willing to tell, that someone else will be heard from in short order if it can be used to as damaging information against Senator Franken. If it is merely a matter of, yeah, this was a really stupid sophomoric kind of thing that then he won't be heard from. Or she. Got it? Hung Like Jesus says, no matter what Franken has done, I don't know. I don't think he's done as a senator. I don't think he's going to stop being the voice that he, because taking a stupid, ill-advised and arguably misogynistic, harassing photo that does not invalidate one's ability to say, for instance, identify perjury on the part of, say, United States Attorney General. What's done is any talk there was of him being a presidential candidate or a part of a vice presidential nominee. That's done. That's out the window. That's gone. That's over. But the people of Minnesota are a forgiving lot and a decent lot. And unless there's somebody out there who can the DFL ticket, Democratic Farm Labor Party, who can be as effective as Al Franken he's not going to be challenged in the primary in, no, in 2020. And the Republicans will always mount somebody, and perhaps they'll try to, I'm sure that photograph. And here's the question. Really? You're going to use that photograph in political campaign ads? Because it's got to be even more painful for Ms. Tweeden to have it splattered from here to yonder. Or maybe not. I mean, there was that. No, not going to mention it. Not going to mention it. But if the Republicans splatter that all over Minnesota in campaign ads, then they become abusers as well. They become promulgators of the abuse on a secondary level. So I don't, hung like Jesus, I understand what you're saying, but I don't think he's done as a United States Senator. Any broader ideas are pretty well over. But then again, I don't think Senator Franken would have ever had a chance anyway, because he's always been ideologically impure because of his support for Israel and his connections to the Israel lobby. Hung Like Jesus said, I jumped over to Breitbart to see what the spin was, and it was at least five headlines deep in bright red. Right, because this is something of which they've dreamed, because look what they've gotten, look at the mileage they've gotten out of it. Suddenly we're talking about this and not a child molester. Okay, let's be clear. That's the difference. A child molester. Because the stories just keep coming out now about Roy Moore, about him calling a little girl in high school, having her brought to the principal's office, and, hey, this is Roy Moore, what are you doing? To which she answered, I'm in trig. Well, you want to go out? Yeah. So you see, you see the problem. But if you were curious as to whether or not this was planned, the fact that Roy Moore was ready at 1:08 p.m. today, the 16th of November 2017, to opine on this matter on Twitter, well, then, you know, I can't help. But at 1:08 p.m., Roy Tola Moore, tweeted, L. Franken admits guilt after photographic evidence of his abuse surfaces. Mitch, let's investigate. In Alabama, zero evidence. Allegations 100% rejected. Mitch, Moore must quit immediately or be expelled. Well, see, that's the problem. Roy apparently has more trouble with mathematics than do I, and I got a lot of trouble with mathematics. Roy seems to think seven women and counting, maybe eight now, none of whom know each other, and all of whom have stories to tell of him creepering on them at the Old Hickory House, at the Red Lobster, in high school trig class, when they were being Santa's helper at the mall. The fact that he was banned from the Gadsden Mall. This apparently equals zero evidence. Wowzer. And yes, Mitch McConnell did jump right out there and declare that there should be an ethics investigation of Al Franken. Was Al Franken even a senator when this went down? Let's see, because I seem to recall that Al Franken was a member of this, was elected to the Senate in 2008 because his recount took forever and a damn day, and therefore there was no real Democratic majority in the Senate in the early parts of 2009 when that Congress came into session. So Al Franken welcomes an ethics investigation into something that he, Al Franken, did when he wasn't a senator. But Mitch McConnell will be there to investigate, and he'll have his most profound attack dogs on there, any one of whom is probably equally guilty of being gropey McGropen groper. Because you can't tell me that a John Cornyn, I mean, come on, he's from Texas. Yeah, come on over here, little darling. Yeah, come on. Yeah, give Uncle Senator John a little smooch right there. Uh-huh. Yeah, they're going to have an investigation of Al Franken for something that happened when Al Franken wasn't a senator. Meanwhile, let us also remember that, as was the case with the woman that Anthrax Coulter mentioned in regard to John Kennedy, full grown adult. Here, on the other hand, we're talking about with Roy Moore, children. Brother Deacon Asa, yes, he was. Moore was creeping at the Red Lobster. Some bitch don't even have the decency to go child molesting at Morton's. Well, it's not like they got a Morton's or a Ruth's Chris in Gadsden. The Red Lobster was where you went when you really wanted to go out to a classy dinner in Gadsden. I know the land of from whence I grew. Arthur says, I doubt Franken's done. My immediate reaction was that it was an attempt to discredit the Moore accusations by having the Franken accusations revealed to be false and to feed the both sides are equal narrative. In fairness, I haven't seen the Franken photo. It's gross. I can't tell if his hands, because she says on her breast, I can't tell if they're on or if he's kind of, because he's very definitely mugging for the camera. It was a stupid thing to do. It was a gross thing to do. It was a skeevy thing to do. Yeah. And I keep trying to open this link. Let me see. That's true, Ron pointing out. And the Red Lobster has oysters. The Red Lobster does have oysters. There we go. Ah, well, thank you. Thank you, Steve. Apparently one can go on the web internet tubes and find pictures of Leanne Tweeden. Hooters girl legend Leanne Tweeden does not disappoint. You know, cheesecake photos. Bare-breasted with her forearms covering her nipples. And like, biting her index fingernail. Yeah, they're kind of... I don't know... In the modern era, what do we call these? Melania photos. They're Melania pictures. There's no nudity, but, well, you know what? Women who pose nude have a right not to be sexually abused, okay? I mean, I point out time and time again that the current First Lady of the United States is, in fact, the first ever First Lady of the United States to take her clothes off for money. This is simply a fact. I'm not making any value judgments. I'm merely mentioning a fact. Dolly Madison never took her clothes off for money. Pat Nixon never took her clothes off for money. Betty Ford, Miss Roslin, Hillary never took their clothes off for money. Lady Bird Johnson, Jackie Kennedy, Mamie Eisenhower, Eleanor Roosevelt, whoever was married to Herbert Hoover, Calvin Coolidge's wife, Edith Wilson, never took their clothes off for money. We now have a first lady who did. And eventually, if we are to understand the way that these sort of through lines run, we will eventually have a first lady who was a full-on prostitute or a straight-up stripper. It'll probably go to stripper, and eventually then to prostitute. At which point we will be in the era of Idiocracy if we aren't already. Again, I am making no value judgments. And so, Lauren Tweeden, regardless of what she did, had a right not to be harassed or groped or improperly kissed. And you know who else had that right? Several little girls that Roy Moore creepered on when he was, 18 years older than them. And I'm pretty sure he wasn't going to introduce them to his vast and voluminous library, sort of the way Captain Royal did with Anne. But Roy was right there, ready to pounce, wasn't he? It's almost like somebody gave him a tip. Like somebody from over at that website that rhymes with light and fart. Isn't it? Yeah. I don't see an issue here. I don't see a comparison. I don't see a comparison between Roy Moore and Al Franken. When it was announced yesterday or the day before that a person was aware of men in the Congress of both parties, it was said at the time. So that means somebody else is coming. Unless, of course, that one's going to be suppressed, at which point in time we'll know exactly what the motivation behind this was. Then you knew, yeah. On the other hand, if this is as good as they've got, or as bad as they've got, well, they haven't gotten to creepered on a 14-year-old little girl or tried to pick up Santa's helper yet. And that, by God, is true, Ron pointing out. And Mary Lincoln never took her clothes off, period. No, she just put more on. In fact, that's one of the more fascinating aspects of history. Had Lincoln not been been assassinated, there is every possibility that after the end of the Civil War, he might well have been impeached, not for his own actions, but for the financial shenanigans of Mary Todd Lincoln, who spent money like a drunken sailor. Just saying, because history's cool. I agree, Ron. Ron says, but whataboutism? Whataboutism seems to be a prevalent theme in the political discourse nowadays. Sorry, I had to make a quick audio tweak. Trying to keep the keep any clipping to a minimum and make it possible still to be heard. Thanks very kindly to little Cletus. Cletus is a sweet puppy. I just got a note. Cletus is proud of the way you took a stand for the Playboy lady and sent you some bones. Oh, God, you're going to... Yeah, the Playboy lady. But again, women who pose naked for Playboy have a right... Yeah, that's a right. Have a right not to be sexually harassed or have sophomoric photos taken of them. Period. I'm trying to... Because, see, this is that whole as-a-dad thing. I mentioned that, and, God, my baby would probably kill me if she heard this. The reason that we're going over and doing the big to-do Thanksgiving next week is because my daughter is just getting over a nasty divorce. And it's one of those situations where, and parents know what this is about. You have to let, when children become adults, or think they are, you have to let them make their own mistakes. Because they will not, if you try to tell them otherwise, they generally won't listen. And Agnes and I have had many conversations since early last year, pointing out the fact that we both knew the guy was a scumbag. Because he is. Wouldn't work. You know, just... Ugh. And consequently... You had to let the thing play out. And so we're going to have a really big Thanksgiving feast next week. I'll spend the better part of the day on Wednesday. That's why I won't be on the air Wednesday night. Smoking the Thanksgiving turkey. I'll have a propane torch for keeping it lit. You don't want to take a deep hit off of when you're smoking a turkey. You just don't. But by the way, let's see, what does that do? $259 to go after Cletus dug up some bones. $259. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. So we're making progress. No, I'm not going to burl the bird in Earl, Marty. That's too adventuresome for me. I'm perfectly happy. No, I'm gonna do the seasonings and everything, and prop the bird up on a can of Foster's on the smoker, and just let the magic happen. I realize that. Asa says, yeah, Mary Todd Lincoln spent money like a drunken sailor, but was she taking U.S. government planes to go on private resort vacations? Well, no, silly man. She was taking U.S. government carriages to go on resort vacations. James with a note. Come on, Bob! Where do you think Bush got the idea? When you're attacked, go on vacation, spend money, buy a new car, horse. Well, that too. Yes, that's right. How could I forget? Let me add to the list. Michelle Obama never took her clothes off in exchange for money. Randy says, I thought we were going to hear some real news. Sorry. Well, we are, but... This is what we got to get out of the way. Because this is what our nation is obsessed with. This is what we're talking about instead of, the 210,000 gallons of oil that have been dumped all over South Dakota from the Keystone Pipeline that's supposed to be safe, that won't dump tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil. Well, I mean, it's just it's only a few hundred thousand. Yeah, do you realize how little oil 210,000 gallons is when you compare it to all the oil that goes through that pipeline? Why that's just a drop in the bucket. Precisely my point. And I also wanted to go back for a moment to something that was mentioned in the Green News Report. And that's this. There was mention of the opening of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to drilling. This has become an article of faith in the Republican Party. And guess what? This doesn't have a goddamn thing to do with Donald Trump. This is all about the Republican Party. They have had a hard-on, they've had a hard-on to fuck the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the way that Roy Moore feels about, 14-year-old little girls. And so last week while I was in D.C., on Tuesday, I think it was, maybe Wednesday, I just happened to open the newspaper. I think it was The Hill. There's always a jillion copies of it sitting in every congressional office. Full page, full color ad. There's in the distance, there are some rising, majestic, snow-covered peaks. Moving into the foreground, some brownish-colored land. There's a blue river running through it, and along the riverbank, some green. And over the photograph are laying the following words. Hunters and anglers agree. The Arctic Refuge is too important to drill. Don't buy the oil industry's tax scam. Fact, developing the refuge will permanently damage fish and wildlife habitat, threatening hunting and fishing traditions. Fact, drilling the refuge would pay for less than 0.01% of the tax plan. Down in the corner, there's a picture of a hunter. He's wearing his camo. He's apparently in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And he's proudly sitting next to and holding the horns of a humongous caribou. BHA member J.R. Young and a caribou he harvested in the refuge fall 2017. You'll notice we don't kill caribou anymore. We harvest them. You know, just like corn, you just sort of cut it off down close to the ground, and then you dry the corn, you strip the kernels off, and you grind them into cornmeal, and they're only with blood and gore and guts and fur and animal. Harvested, yes. But that's not the point. The point is the message of the ad. The Arctic Refuge is too important to drill. And that day, I looked at the staffer we were talking to, and I grabbed my copy of the paper, Roll Call or The Hill or whatever it was. Maybe it was Politico, for all I know. And I just whipped it open and laid it on the table, and I said, Bub, if the Arctic Refuge is too important to drill, and I agree that it is, then Appalachia is too important to blast, and your boss needs to get off his butt and do something. Because it's true. Because at the same time that was going on, there's a story that hasn't been getting much attention lately. Maybe it's just not important because, hillbilly. But while Kaiser Kumquat was in China a little something happened. And the little something that happened was the fire sale of the entire state of West Virginia. Missed that one, did you? Yeah. While that whole thing was going on, some West Virginia folks went to China too, and they signed a memorandum of understanding, and granted, memorandums of understanding don't always lead to completion of the thing that was said to have been memorialized and understood. But a memorandum of understanding was signed with the Chinese that sold West Virginia to China for the sum of $83.7 billion to be paid out over 20 years. These are the same kind of deals that the Chinese government strikes with, say, Mozambique. You get the idea. Yeah, so $83.7 billion. I'm going to cheat and use the calculator machine. 83.7 divided by 20 equals. That's $4.185 billion a year to develop fracking, pipeline, natural gas, and coal assets in West Virginia. You know how I've talked from time to time about I won't leave here, that short of the indigenous people who were here first by about 15,000 years, that my bunch has as great a claim to be here as anybody on earth and a right to enjoy it in something resembling peace and quiet, and that therefore, when people say, well, Bob, why don't you move? That the idea is tempting, but I don't have the wherewithal to go, and there's nowhere else out there where I can have an 80-year-old rundown house on an acre of ground that I can go out and run my weed eater on and pee off the back porch or whatever. Yeah, because, I mean, there are places in this country I love, but I can't go there. I can't afford to live there. We can't even get 400 people to subscribe at $10 a month so that I can stop fundraising for this program. As Scott noted when he kindly started the fundraiser that led to Agnes and me being able to take a honeymoon after 24 years of marriage, if I'm not here, the whole thing collapses. So there's no way I could raise an extra, $1,500 for a house payment somewhere that I'd like to go. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out if I can just get health insurance, and that's going to be a problem. And so when people say, hey, Bob, why don't you get out of there? That raises my hackles, and I say, well, no, by God, they can leave. I'm not gonna. My people have been here for 11 generations. They're a bunch of Johnny Blast Latelys. But if this there are oddly enough no details, and we'd love to share the details, but the dog ate them. When people like Ken Ward Jr. ask for what goes into it, I can't tell you. Well, one thing's for sure. There are a couple of people who will reap a tremendous economic benefit out of it. One of them's Jim Justice, and the other one's a guy named Thrasher who is one of his minions. But it may get to the point where if you don't leave, you die. Because if this thing comes to fruition, this place is going to explode. And nowhere is going to be safe. I mentioned to you before that right before you get to the mall in Beckley, there's a huge, must be 10 football fields, of pipe, like 3 foot around pipe, stacked 5 or 6 high for a pipe, for the Mountain View pipeline that they're hell bent on building and won't be much opposed. Well, there's another similar staging area to the north of me up at the juncture of Interstate 79 and US 19. And for all I know, they may go right through my goddamn backyard. And the plans are afoot to go anywhere they want to because they will use eminent domain to run over top of anybody who resists them. Add to that fact that virtually no one in West Virginia owns their mineral rights because those things were bought up back toward the late 19th century and early 20th century. There's not that many people anywhere in the country that own their mineral rights. So lo and behold, the folks at Keystone have grudgingly admitted that their never-gonna-leak pipeline just vomited out 210,000 gallons of pure toxic filth onto the ground in South Dakota. And that happened today. 210,000 gallons is about 5,000 barrels of oil. And they're scrambling to clean it up in the northeast corner of South Dakota, near Amherst. Meanwhile, down in Nebraska, regulators there are just now getting to the point where they're considering whether to grant the final permit for construction to begin on a different proposal, the Keystone XL. That decision should be rendered on Monday. You want to guess what that decision will be? Well, we're going to grant the permit. I mean, they already had their spill up in South Dakota. What's the chances of one happening here? Law averages, right? TransCanada issued a statement, of course, saying we detected the leak about 6 a.m. local time Thursday. That portion of the pipeline was completely isolated within 15 minutes. I'd say it was completely isolated before it leaked, or else maybe somebody would have been there to catch the leak. But, you know, that would require manpower, and then that means paying salaries, and that means that the CEO of TransCanada doesn't get a 24-karat gold spittoon come Christmas time. The cause of the leak is under investigation. Really, Sherlock's? You know what the cause of the leak is? The pipeline! The presence of the pipeline is the cause of the leak. If there was not a pipeline there, there would not be 210,000 gallons of oil spreading out across the prairie somewhere near Amherst, South Dakota. Clear enough? I love the reporting. An official at the sheriff's office in Marshall County, South Dakota, said she could not answer questions about the spill and referred calls to TransCanada. You might want to call TransCanada. Yeah, we don't know nothing about that. Meanwhile, TransCanada said in its statement, TransCanada appreciates the collaborative support of local officials, emergency response personnel, and commissioners in Marshall County, whom we bought off previously. Oh, I added that part. As well as the landowner who has given permission to access land for assessment, identification, and cleanup activities. Given permission? You're lucky the landowner didn't show up with a goddamn shotgun and say, get the little sons of bitches out here and clean up my land that you promised you weren't going to fucking poison. Well, you know, it's just a darkened field. I mean, it's just some oil laying on some dirt. What's the big deal? As Earther points out, but don't worry, that'll be the only time they had a spill. They promise, and that's the kind of promise you can believe, like when an alcoholic promises not to drink again when he's drunk. Nobody can get anywhere near the spill now because it's been blocked off by law enforcement. But that's okay. Kelly Martin, a tree hugger with Sierra Club, said, "We've always said it's not a question of whether a pipeline will spill, but when, and today TransCanada is making our case for us. This is not the first time TransCanada's pipeline has spilled toxic tar sands, and it won't be the last." No, it won't be. In fact, it's probably one of many. Yes, Steve in New York asks, Keystone, is that part of the MAGA plan? Why, yeah, that's how we make America great again, Steve, by covering it in tar sands crude from the hellish moonscapes of northern Alberta. James says, cause of leak? Oil's just trying to find its way back where it belongs, under the ground. Randy says, or, you know, when a corporation promises a judge that it was only a one-time thing. Right. And, well, I guess Roy Moore is glad now that he didn't say that. Well, I mean, I asked her out, but I didn't. It's not like I was creeping around all over the mall. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, Ron notes, someone should fire a flare into the spill to burn it off. And a bright light was seen in the east. Well, that's only if you're west of Aberdeen, South Dakota. You don't want to confuse people, Ron, because, I mean, from down, it'd be a bright light was seen in the northwest. Can't no wise men come from the northwest? Sorry. I mean, you're wise, but you know what I mean. It's the holidays, for Christ's sakes. Oh, and by the way, just because shallow. Oh, Steve notes, not to put too fine a point on it, but I don't give a shit about the people of South Dakota being poisoned. At some point, one's patience runs out. This is that time. Would you care to elaborate, Steve? I mean, is this because they're maggots? Because there are people in South Dakota who have been in South Dakota since, like, you know, the last 10,000 years or so. And I'm not quite, you know, willing to go maybe where you went. To be fair, the people at TransCanada don't give a shit about the people of South Dakota. That's why they're running their goddamn toxic, leaky, one of these days is going to blow the Kingdom Come pipeline through there. Won't it be cool when they get to build a pipeline through the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? I know. Hey, let's go over and check in with Hung Like Jesus. Hey, Hung.
Hey, Bob, and everybody listening.
One thing real quick. I'm digging the video, but you can turn it off because it'll save us a lot of bandwidth and make sure we got good audio.
I don't have a video. I don't have it on.
Dude, you do. I'm looking at you. Okay. Hey, man.
Hold on. I see it now. Hold on.
Nice ceiling fan.
Oh, you see it? I'm playing a bit. All right. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. A few years ago, when I got divorced, a really rough time, almost killed me, as a matter of fact, I met a young lady. When I got divorced, I think I was 39 or 40, something like that. And she was 25. And though I've always enjoyed older women, you know, I figured, you know, I was going through a little something and this would have been a welcome change for me. It wasn't. I have no idea what a 34-year-old, 32-year-old, or whatever, how old he was, is doing with a 14, could even look in the direction of a 14, 16, 18-year-old girl and find something over there that would, I mean, of course, you know, obviously, you know, we could find interest in it, but anything outside of that, And even that, for me, I just can't understand it. And I've been thinking about this for a while, and I just cannot do it. And, you know, I live not too far from elementary school, and I'm thinking 14, maybe middle school, elementary school, I'm not sure. And I'm looking at these girls as these children as they walk past. I'm like, really? What is it that would even interest me in any of that over there? I just can't understand it myself.
Can we kind of drill down into that for a minute? I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, like, no, yours is the normal response. And this is one of those instances where normal isn't just a setting on a dryer. There is a socially acceptable, normal response to this sort of thing. Anybody like Roy Moore at the age of 32 who looks at a 14-year-old little girl and says, I want that. Right. There's something wrong. Okay, let's just say there's something wrong with Roy Moore. Okay? And look at, how about this, too? Because this sort of dawned on me earlier today. 14-year-olds, and we all... I don't know what you were doing when you were 14. I was dreaming that someday I might have sex, but I wasn't having sex.
Right.
Well, I mean, okay. I remember the first time I had sex. I was alone at the time.
I think most of us were.
So, but even 14-year-olds, and we have programs to try to keep them. And Republicans do this, Hung. Okay, this is a Republican thing. Do you remember the Reign of Error? And the whole abstinence only sex education.
Okay, yes.
And so they were telling 14-year-olds, don't fuck.
Right.
Please, little 14-year-olds, don't fuck. Don't make babies. Because at 14 years old, you're not going to be much in the way of a parent.
Right.
So, and you know, meanwhile, the liberal, heathen, homosexual, godless, satanic, baby-eating, fetus on a cracker Democrats were saying, you know, maybe we should tell them how sex works and that's how you do get pregnant and that there's ways not to get pregnant because 14-year-olds are going to have sex. Well, when Democrats said that, Hung, they weren't saying 14-year-olds are going to have sex with 32-year-old district attorneys.
Right. But, you know, that whole Puritan thing and putting it and hiding everything in the closet, you know, I think that might generate a lot of that deviant behavior that comes out of some folk, and some folk on the right most, because those are the ones that, you know, to pretend the most, and the ones that are mostly in the closet, you know, the men that were in the bathrooms.
I got one of those, man. I got one of those today, because the goddess of irony is a good goddess. A Christian family values Republican, a member of the legislature in the state of Ohio, by the name of Wes Goodman, age 33, a married man who had stuff all over his webpage about traditional family values marriage between one man and one woman, kind of got caught with a man in his mouth. And, of course, I refer to the late, great Bart Kopp, peace be upon him, when I use that phrase, got caught with a man in his mouth. The Columbus Dispatch wrote, rumors about Goodman's questionable conduct, including his use of social media, have been swirling at the State House in the past few weeks and include stories dating back years to when he worked in Washington. His Facebook account was taken offline. he was a staffer, by the way, for one of the most fire-breathing members of the Freedom Caucus, Jim Jordan of Ohio. And
a person's sexual preference, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, you like whatever you like, but when you preach one thing and then do another, that's when it becomes ugh.
Well, that's when the right to pass judgment attaches.
Right.
Because,
well, I mean, if your preference is 14-year-old girls, of course, then we can't have that. We have prisons for that.
Well, exactly. And, you know, the community dealt with Roy Moore as best it could, because, you know, in Alabama, I mean, you probably know Southern culture. In Alabama, they're not going to do that to somebody who doesn't have any... they're not going to do that to anybody except those who have no access to power.
Right.
Now, if that had been some skeevy drunk wandering around the mall asking little 14-year-old girls out, the cops would have run him, and he probably would have been arrested and found some way to get into the prison system. Right. But this was the district attorney of Etowah County, Alabama. So they just go to him quietly, and they say, Roy, it's kind of like what Marcy was talking about the other night. Roy, I've heard what you've been doing, and it ain't right, and I don't want you to do it anymore. You need to not be doing it, and we'll have to do something. We'll have to do something more than talk next time if we hear you doing it anymore. Meantime, you don't need to be going to the mall anymore. You want to go to the mall? You just
do it elsewhere.
Yeah, you want to go to the mall? You just go to Birmingham or something. All right, all right.
But you know, what about people with no? I don't have any children, but I can imagine if I was a father with a 14-year-old girl, you know, the apple of my eye, my little girl, and some grown. Some grown man, 32 years old.
Mutant.
Yes. You know, it would be nothing that would keep me from him. It wouldn't be a cop in Georgia that would keep me from him. I don't know where these fathers are, if these girls had fathers, or they could even get to Roy, or what the deal was as far as that went.
Well, but okay, you've just raised another question. What was that line about, I never dated any girls that I didn't get permission from their mama?
Yeah, well...
Am I to presume that Roy didn't ask permission from Daddy?
Oh, you can believe he didn't ask permission from Daddy if Daddy was around.
Because Daddy would have beat a mud hole in him.
Yes. And Daddy would have been in prison still right now, probably.
So, the contradictions here just won't quit. And I think that's why it gets such a grip on our consciousness, our attention, because there's a whole lot of introspection going on. Like Al Franken said in his statement, there are men all over America who are sort of stopping and doing a check to say, you know, have I ever been that way?
Right.
And a lot of men are going, oh, you know, I've probably not been as nice as I should have been.
Bob, this time of year at work, we have a lot of temps that come in. And, you know, people you don't know, and people do things, different things, say different things to people that they don't know. And, you know, and I don't know if this is wrong, and maybe it is, and you can tell me if it's wrong, or someone can call in and tell me if it's wrong, but I have on more than one occasion, went up to a woman that I thought was attractive, and I said, I don't want you to think that I'm harassing you sexually, but... Whatever. Now, I don't know if that's wrong to even start off a statement like that when you're talking to a woman. And if it is, you know, I am really sorry about it, but I was not.
Well, you've just identified the problem. Because this is actually an evolutionary moment for humanity, at least in this country. Because, you know, it's no longer the Iron Age. And even this sort of thing comes up into the modern era in some places. So we're not bartering and selling women in exchange for a few camels and goats and chickens and whatnot.
Right.
Which was just, I mean, that's disgusting. We don't treat, toward the end of the 19th century, we began to get these things in the law called Married Women's Property Acts, which said that women could actually own property. I mean, this is one of those things that's kind of mind-blowing to contemplate, but it's a fairly recent development that women were allowed to own property separate and apart from their husbands.
Right.
And if they had access to property or title to property and they didn't have husbands, then some man had to look after their property rights.
Right.
This is the kind of thing that obtains to this day in places like Saudi Arabia.
As Gary said, this is America we're talking about.
But it's America we're talking about. And so, right. So the question thank God Agnes isn't listening. Are you, honey? She's not here. I'm assuming she's not. She's probably busy with the grandkids. So I'll say, yeah, I looked at Agnes and I said, you know, granted, we've been married almost 25 years, and you know, we play a little slap and tickle with each other. I mean, we've been married for 25 years. We don't even remember who gets tied up anymore, okay?
Right.
But we're affectionate with each other. And it was so sweet, because she looked at me and she said, oh, honey, you just touch me anytime you want to, okay? And I went, really?
Yeah.
And she went, stop it. but those are the kind of, we're having those kinds of conversations now. How do you ask someone out?
Right.
The traditional, and this is just gross, but you know, the traditional, and that makes it sound like there was raccoon coats involved and banners and bula bula and shit. But no, like college, every college town back at one point or another, and probably to this day, had what was known as a hookup bar.
Yeah.
And the college town also had a bar that was known as the Bar of Last Resort.
Yep.
If you'd struck out all night long, you wound up at that bar, and that was your last chance to not go home alone.
Hey, Bob, at my school we had a club that I forgot what night it was on. This is an aside. And whoever hung around when the lights came on, those are the people that hooked up. So it was just whoever closes the club down, those are the ones who are looking to hook up. So that's
yeah, one of those. Well, exactly. And it's, if you put on your Sir Richard Attenborough narration voice, then you know you can see it as sort of clannish tribal behavior. You know, just because we're modern and we drive cars and we take expensive medications and have houses that don't have thatched roofs, doesn't right. mean that we no don't problems. Still behave. You know, one of the fundamental problems of humanity, from diet outward, is that we still eat like hunter-gatherers, but we don't live that way.
Right.
I mean, that's where the diabetes and a lot of the early-onset heart disease and all of that comes from. You can eat sausage and bacon and beef with eggs for breakfast and load on the carbs and the protein as long as you're working like a dog all day long.
Right. You know, I remember telling my therapist a few years ago that I forgot how we got on that subject. He said, you know, we're just basically cavemen with cell phones. I don't know how we got on it, but, you know, that's what it was boiled down to.
But it's the truth.
Yeah.
It's absolutely the truth. And the same thing applies to mating and copulation rituals.
But listen, you know, and like you said, you know, you really don't. And now that it's in the forefront of everybody's mind, you really do not know how to compliment a woman, not anymore, not easily anymore, or how to ask a woman out. I'm single, happily so. And, you know, if I see a woman that's attractive, I will pay her a compliment and keep moving. I won't look back. I won't wait for a response. I'll just pay her a compliment. And then I'll just keep moving. Therefore, she knows it was just a compliment. I wasn't trying to get her phone number or anything else. It was just I was appreciating, you know, a beautiful woman, and I kept moving. But I don't know now. I don't know if that's going to even. I don't know if I could even get away with that anymore.
And I don't know either. And it's all a matter of consent.
Right.
You know, if you, for instance, and I've got a fairly well refined sense of smell. And there are some colognes and perfumes that I really like and some that just make me want to retch in the gutter.
Right.
And so I'll say, you know, that's a really wonderful scent you've got on. What is it? And it's not because I'm trying to perv or skeeve or it's like, you know, hey, I might buy that for my wife.
Right.
And you know, that's generally not off-putting, but it's also not, baby, I love your perfume. Do you want a...
Right. But I think women can tell the difference between someone that's a creep and someone who's genuine, just want, you know, just appreciate them. I think they can. I remember one time mentioning perfumes and women. I can remember when I was much younger. We were in one of the malls here. And this lady walked past, probably in her late teens or whatever. She walked past... And she had some, and her perfume smelled really, really good. And the first thing that popped in my mind, and I was really, really free with my mouth back then, the first thing that popped into my mind is when I walked into it, I see your perfume makes me want to take a bite out of your ass. I remember saying that.
Yeah, okay, let's put that on the list of things we don't do anymore.
But I wouldn't say that anymore, no. It's... But, you know, hey, that's I wouldn't definitely wouldn't say it now in my old age, but yes, I thought that way.
And look, there's teaching that has to happen. And there's generational teaching that has to happen. And, I mean, there are so many aspects to this. Now, it wasn't... Now, when we're talking about the Roy Moore era, when he was 32 and she was 14,
yeah.
We're talking about... Let's see, he's 70 now, so that was... 38 years ago? If I got
I think
it
was 77, somewhere around there, 77, 78.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, the late 70s. Mall culture, kids hanging out at the mall.
Right.
I remember what the kids I grew up with dressed like. 77, 78, I was a freshman in high school. I think the woman who was 14-year-old, Ms. Korfman, I think she's a couple of, well, no, no, his wife is a couple of years older than me. But anyway... what I'm kind of getting at here is that the marketing of clothing was still in a certain degree of its infancy, but in the modern era, Hung, we've got
oh God,
we have the sexualization of little girls. Okay,
yes.
And on the one hand, I don't want to sound like some sort of moralizing right winger, and you never say what was she wearing, but I do object to, and I object in the same sense that I object to, like the Honey Boo Boo, JonBenet Ramsey.
Yes, all of that. Yes,
all of that pageantizing stuff, making little girl, you know, little goddamn toddlers look like they're older than they are.
Right.
I mean, we know that there are real things out there in the world called pedophiles.
Definitely.
Why would you want to play into their sickness?
Exactly, and that's what I was going to say. I often wonder sometimes, what do these mothers think, and these fathers as well, when they dress their little girls up, and not so little girls up in the clothes of that. I don't know if they don't know that they have these things on. But sometimes if you are, you know, because honestly, you know, high school girls back when I was in high school, and I graduated in 85, when I was in high school, and the girls now, I mean, there's no comparison. I mean, these girls, really, high school, what, 17? I can't even believe. I don't know.
There are so many different places you can look in pop culture. I mentioned it a week or so ago, over a week ago, because I was gone last week. I heard a song, I think it was, what was his name? Ray Davis? But there was this, you know, creepy rock and roll. I think of Nick Gilder, Hot Child in the City.
Yeah,
running wild and looking pretty.
What is that?
Or she was only 16.
That's
she
exactly
was only
what I was thinking
16.
Of. Yeah, she's only 16, right?
The police singing every breath. You know, the ultimate stalker's anthem, "Every Breath You Take." And we're talking about songs that have made millions of dollars for people.
Yep.
And had an entire planet humming or singing along with them.
Yeah, I've sang along with many of them, innocently so, because I would, you know, I wasn't, well, you know. Come, matter of fact, you know, the Police had a, when they, I think it was one of their first singles, it was, I think it was called the Do Do Do, when they, the guy was, staying
the Do Do Do, da 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 da, yeah.
Yeah, the video, he was a teacher. And so,
oh, no, that's Don't Stand So Close to Me.
Don't Stand So Close to Me. Young teacher, the subject of schoolgirl fantasy. That's the same thing.
Yeah, and you know what? The schoolgirl wasn't fantasizing about the young teacher. The young teacher was fantasizing about the schoolgirl.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Come on, Mr. Sumner.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Gordon Sumner had been a public school maths teacher in the UK.
Yeah.
And even something, and there's a much deeper meaning to it, Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita.
I never could understand Lolita. I've heard people talk about it in references recently, but I've never seen the movie, and I never understood it, so I couldn't.
The original movie it's just completely different. There's a big difference between that and the book. The book, the first few pages, and everybody, banned in Boston. Oh my God, this is disgusting. But if you read the whole thing, it doesn't come out being what it sounds like in the beginning.
Okay.
It's an example of how things that are art can be profoundly misunderstood. And parallel to this, I remember many, many years ago when the religious right was having one of its occasional hissies over things in the library. And one of the books that they wanted to ban was called, wait for it, Making It in the Kitchen with Mary. Jesus Christ, that's filthy.
That is disgusting.
However, it was a cookbook.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But the right wing's filthy mind got all over it, and they had Mary on the kitchen table, right?
Yeah, when you repress those feelings and those things that you come natural, when those things are repressed, of course they're going to come out in all kind of crazy ways, and you're going to project all kind of crazy things on other people.
Here's another rock and roll submission from Steve from Georgistan. How about ZZ Top's Francine? My Francine just turned 13. She's my angelic teenage queen.
That could be his daughter, though.
Yeah, I don't think that's how the I don't think the band that gave us "She Wants a Pearl Necklace" had that in mind. Aerosmith, Big Ten Inch, record of the band that plays the blues. Yeah, clever. Yeah, goddamn, all the way back to Chuck Berry.
Well, they were marrying 13 and 14 year old girls back then, weren't they?
Jerry Lee Lewis was.
Yeah, well.
But that got him shit. That got him in deep shit, Jerry Lee.
I don't know the backstory of it.
A 100 years before that, a girl being married off at 14, you're damned right.
Right.
And dead of childbirth before she was 30.
Well.
So there is this learning curve that we're trying to sort out here, and what used to be brutish, semi-accepted male behavior, or not accepted but tolerated male behavior, is finally unaccepted, and that's a step forward.
Well, but let me ask you this. Now, of course, you always want to believe a woman when she says she's been assaulted sexually anyway. I mean, you don't want to question her, at least not at that time. You don't want to question her. Even if it's, even if you have questions, you don't want to question her at that time. But do you think this is, because this can become a form of terrorism. Do you think this is setting up women to, who weren't put in positions where they could maybe excel at work, maybe they get to raise them, or whatever the situation is, to threaten to go public with some sort of made-up accusations?
I'm not terribly worried about that, because we have to understand in the beginning that the number of women who do not report this kind of activity is far in excess of those who do. So it takes a whole bunch of gumption and determination to report it in the first place.
Right.
And we still have a legal system that subjects the victim to as much trauma or more than they experienced in the first place.
Right. Well, the kind of woman that wouldn't do it, of course, wouldn't do it. But you have the kind of woman that would do it or would even consider it. And it could, it could just be one well-placed accusation that could just ruin someone's life.
And some of it, like the Franken thing, is just embarrassing.
Yeah.
He's ashamed and embarrassed of himself, probably beyond his ability to express it, and he's a very expressive human being. There are passes that are innocently made. It goes back to that question of, you know, how do you convey your interest? And we're still enough of a patriarchy that it's not accepted for a woman to be aggressive in pursuing a man. And so you wind up with the equivalent of the seventh grade dance, where all the girls are over on one side of the gym and all the boys are standing over on the other side of the gym, and they each want to talk to each other, but they're scared to fucking death of each other.
Right. I'm still scared of women.
Oh, And
most of us are. Most of us are.
I think there's probably truth in that. And so when you finally do, as Lady Macbeth says in the Scottish play, screw your courage to the sticking place, you wind up doing something stupid.
Right.
I mean, there were full-on conversations I remember in college of from a chess perspective, the opening gambit. How do you start the conversation? Hi, you're pretty. And at that point in time, you realize, you know, it's over. But physical attraction is what gets the ball rolling, because we're not, you know, we don't have females whose butts turn red when it's mating season,
right?
Or guys whose genitals they kind of do, but never mind.
Well,
silly shit. Like, I knew a guy who would walk up to a girl in a bar and say, in a thick and heavy Russian accent, Are you Natasha, my secret contact?
Oh, God.
Yeah, it was terrible. But one in 19 times, she'd go, yeah, I am. And so the conversation begins. Can I buy you a drink? Jesus, is there anywhere in the world, in the known universe, where that is not actually translated into, I hope we will eventually have sex?
Right. Right,
and so you wind up in this uncomfortable nether world where it feels like anything you say is going to be wrong. Nice day, sicko.
The reason why I asked about the possible false accusations is because it happened to me from a lady that had gotten fired from work, and this is when I was working at Kodak some years ago. She had gotten fired at work, and her parting statement was that I sexually harassed her, which was of course not true. She was, I don't know why we didn't get along for whatever reason, but she thought I was behind her getting fired, and that was her part in the statement. Of course, they did. The people, my employees knew that, employers knew that I wasn't that type of person, and I was heavily married at the time, heavily. So it was nothing I would even consider. But you know, I'm just, it's something that's, you know, it's tossed up in the air, and then it just hangs there. Did he? Maybe. Well, I don't know.
Well, and in a situation like that, you're only, if you haven't done anything, your response is to go, no, we didn't get along, and in fact, I hated her guts.
Right.
And I guess that's where, because people, that, and again, it's a confusing time. We are only in, what, women entering the workplace happens on a large scale as a result of World War II.
Yeah, right.
So let's say 1940. Let's just use a round number. So that's 77 years of women in the workplace and 77 years of trying to figure out how we interact. And then you get something like, and all of this stuff is manifested in the popular culture. Mm-hmm. You get something like Mad Men. Where you've got and the props guy and the costume props people and the costume people did a magnificent job, but they, you know, I guess in the 60s, women who worked in offices walked around in dresses that looked like they were poured into them every morning. I don't know, and that of course then leads to the reprehensible behavior of the male characters.
But in the 60s, you could say anything to a woman in an office environment.
Yeah, and because she was powerless.
Right, powerless, right.
And it, you know, that's certainly not any kind of benchmark standard or point of reference. So it is confusing, but there's pretty obviously a line, and we see it in Roy Moore. We see it, Jesus. Look at this. We talk about Roy Moore than we talk about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a walking manual on how not to treat women.
Right.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine how he talks to Melania in front of a little Boron?
Right. Hell, he definitely does it on camera, but he made it to the highest office in the land. So what does that reinforce? That we can do these things.
Yeah, it's the whole history. We're swamped in it, and people of goodwill are trying to figure out how we make it better. And that's what this conversation is, or at least that's the way I perceive it.
But to me, it could go the opposite way, and it could just make those situations more hostile between men and women, like how now white males feel if they're the ones being discriminated against, completely made up, of course. Do you think it could go back that way? Well, now men think they're being attacked because everything they say is going to be judged or misconstrued as some sort of harassment.
Well, look at the premise of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale.
Right. Beautiful, beautiful show, too.
That entire scenario comes into being as a result of backlash against the empowerment of women.
Right.
And look at the secular societies of as awful as the Shah was in Iran, and he was, and we were basically propping up a monster. They had a secular society where women didn't have to walk around covered from head to toe lest they inflame the lust of some powerless man.
Right.
I mean, let's remember, Islam adopts in toto. The patriarchs and the prophets. So you've got and so the Iranian revolution takes place, the Ayatollahs come in, and boom, women, the first thing they do is they repress the females of the culture. Granted, Saddam tried to kill his daddy, but the fact of the matter was, he was a brutal dictatorial strongman who was running a secular culture, because he was, to one extent or another, trying to drag an Islamic state kicking and screaming into the 20th century. So you had women able to walk freely down the streets without being tortured by religious police.
But isn't the religion mainly the cause of women being treated the way they are now worldwide?
I think in most instances, yes. Certainly the most patriarchal elements of our culture now come from the religious right in this country, and they're the ones who are mounting a full-throated defense of Roy Moore.
Of course, but if you even look at say Mennonites or say the Mormons out there, Latter-day Saints, I don't know what
same sect, yeah,
they
subordination
they
of women.
The women are covered from head to absolute toe.
And it's not even anything as exotic as, say, the Amish or anything like that. We got Pentecostals around here. The women.
Oh, Pentecostals, right. Yeah.
The women wear their hair up to Jesus or down to their ankles.
Right.
And all you ever see them in are these sad, shapeless, homemade denim dresses that go down to their ankles.
Right.
And that's not to say that I've got a thing and I'm out scoping for Pentecostal women, but you just notice these things inside the culture.
Right. But it's true.
And that there are elements of Judaism that do it to their women. Hinduism. I mean, it's anywhere there is a patriarchal scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Its first target will be the female of the species. The interesting oppositional corollary to that is that we know scientifically that the single best measure of happiness in a culture, the single greatest indicator of success in a culture, is to be had in one data point: the degree to which women have access to reproductive choice, the degree to which women are free to use birth control and not be forced into pregnancy every time they have sex or thereabouts, is the single factor that is most likely to indicate whether or not that will be a viable culture.
Right.
And whether or not there will be starvation in that culture. Look at the indigenous people of the United of North America and Central and South America, for that matter. They knew what it would mean if their tribe overpopulated, and so they very carefully maintained small families. And that's not because indigenous people didn't have sex.
Right.
That's because they practiced forms of birth of pregnancy, not birth, pregnancy control. But the church steps in and says that's a sin, because if you don't force women to have lots and lots of babies, the church winds up being hard pressed for membership, and then they don't have the money, and well, then the cardinal can't build the palace. And also, you know, doesn't have the power to dictate what's right and what's wrong. And of course, the first thing they say is wrong is trying not to get pregnant.
Right. Well, being a married man, I can tell you, if the woman is not happy in the house, then the house is not going to be happy. I don't give a damn what goes on there. If the woman is not happy, it's not going to be a happy place.
No, and if it's a cooperative effort of each partner trying to make the other happy, then it's got a much greater chance of survival.
Right.
And happiness is something we measure that cannot be measured by one quantitative factor. But if you're absolutely right, if the partners in the marriage aren't, and once again, you've got a paternalistic patriarchal religion that'll step in and say, well, I don't care how fucking unhappy you are, you're staying married because Jesus says so.
Right.
Well, that's going to
make it work.
That's you know, the state of Ohio has put off the execution of a man. And his back, you know, he committed a horrible, horrible murder, and then he killed again.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's an argument to be had for the death penalty, I guess he's it. But in an effort to keep the state of Ohio from killing him, they detailed his upbringing. And holy Jesus, no wonder this guy turned out the way he turned out. I mean, we're talking about. We're talking about a person who, as a child, was tortured by his father, and was forced to watch his father beat his mother as though he was a boxer and she was his opposition. All of his children had to watch while he beat their mother bloody and often unconscious. His father beat the children and molested the guy's sisters, probably molested the guy himself. Eventually, the father was imprisoned for incest, at which point the kid, 10 years old, begins a long spiral through a state system that wasn't much interested in trying to help him. And so, he's not going to be killed by the state until at least 2019, because he got a stay of execution from the governor after there was some publicity over the massive efforts that the state of Ohio was making to kill this guy. because he's so sick after all his years in prison, he's on the verge of death.
Right.
They can't find, they couldn't find a vein to get the needles in to poison him.
Is that not, I thought I read something about, maybe it's a different story, I thought I read something about someone was going to be executed, I'm not sure if it was Ohio or not, and they were going to make a special pill for him to
lay down. Yes, that's the guy, that's the guy.
So they're going to make him more comfortable as they tried to kill him.
Alva Campbell.
Right.
And when they started digging around trying to find a vein as they were going to kill him, he was screaming. And at that point in time, it becomes something much more closely resembling torture.
Right.
But we, and so, you know, and that ain't a one-off. It's that's why we have a divorce system. But the divorce system has been tilted toward, tilted against women who wanted out of bad marriages. Look at the, and one of the best indications in all of this, look at the men, the so-called, it's a right-wing bunch of just disgusting pukes, the so-called men's rights movement.
I heard of that.
Oh, don't go looking around, because, I mean, you want to talk about going into the, into a toxic malarial swamp of the internet. Jesus Christ. But you know these are the kinds of people who probably also believe in reverse racism,
right? Ironically, right.
In point of fact, I'm being informed that I mentioned Iran a minute ago. The father of the Shah, Reza Pahlavi, had his goon squad go around. And they forced women to take off their headgear, their hijab.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sort of the same way that Kemal Ataturk, when he tried to drag the last shreds of the Ottoman Empire into the kicking and screaming into modernity, the first thing he did was outlaw the fez. In an effort to create a secular state. Of course, that's all going down the toilet now. As the world spirals backwards.
I don't know. Did you see the story where they had 60,000 right wing? I forgot what they called them. I'm not sure if they were socialists or not, but they marched in Poland. I think it was 60,000.
Oh, 60,000 right wingers in Poland. I saw that. Yeah, right. That nice little fascist rally.
Right. I thought that was incredible for Poland. 60,000 people.
Well, but they came from all over Europe, because you can get away with stuff in Poland that you couldn't get away with in Germany. There were probably a bunch of them Germans.
Okay.
And
okay.
Remember when Tangerine Tiberius went to Poland and spoke? There were people in the crowd who were waving the Confederate flag, because in Europe the Confederate flag is understood to be a stand-in for the swastika.
Right. It is here, too. We just like to pretend.
Yeah, we do a lot of pretending here. Hey, Hung, it's been a great conversation, man. I really appreciate you jumping in.
All right. Thank you, too, Bob.
You have yourself a good evening, man. We'll talk
you
soon.
You, too.
Bye now.
All right.
And it wasn't, and maybe it wasn't much help, but I don't know in this era. I mean, Harvey Weinstein is easy. That's a guy leveraging power. It's not about sex. It's about dominance. It's the same thing that leads male dogs to pee on trees, okay? Other things are not so easy. Roy Moore's easy. Don't perv on 14-year-olds. But it becomes more complicated with things like Al Franken. It's not so complicated, say, when it's an allegation about, Sylvester Stallone. An allegation has been made now that he pressured a teen into a threesome and then told her that he would beat her head in. At the time, he was 40 years old and he wanted to have a threesome with this girl, this teenage girl, and his bodyguard. But if there's any benefit to be had, it is that maybe we will begin to learn from this. I don't know. I kind of wish Agnes was here. She could chime in on it and maybe provide a little bit more context. Anyway, that's the program. Thorn in the Side Thursday is done. And we are down to, what was it? We got rid of the 33 cents. $254 to go. So that means tomorrow's fundraising goal will be $454. Thanks, everybody. Thanks so much to all of you for knocking it down as much as it did. It gets kind of terrifying when the numbers reach that way. So thanks to everybody who keeps the program going. Thanks to all of you who share in whatever way that you do. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks this evening to Pinch Hit Utility Midweek chat room moderator and all-around great guy Steve from Georgistan. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox and Ben Birch. And thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.